share with us for 20 to 25 minutes, after which there will be a secretary's break. The meeting will then go to a show of hands until 9:05 p.m. The last 10 minutes are reserved for those who feel they may drink and haven't had the chance to share. And now to share her experience, she can hope with us, we have Chaya.
Hi, I'm Chaya, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you. This was my home group for many years, my first 7.5 years sober. And this place saved my life, and I'm really grateful and feel blessed that I get to be here and share with you my experience, strength, and hope. My sobriety date is December 7, 2002. I was 10 when I got sober. Not. my home group now is Ninjas in Recovery, and it meets on Wednesday night at 8 p.m. not too far from here. You should come check it out. It's amazing. And I have a sponsor, and I sponsor others, and I still do the same things that I was told to do at the beginning. Those are the things that saved my life then and continue to save my life on a daily basis. So I still do that. Nothing's changed in that regard. But the way I feel has definitely changed, that's for sure. And my interactions with the world and people about me have changed as a result of this work. So to start off, how I qualify as an alcoholic, I heard someone say this when I was pretty new, and I identified so much. I was like, yeah, me too. So it's pretty much like my whole drunkalogue in like a sentence. And he said, when I drink, I turn into a pig. And I was like, yeah, me too. So there you go. That's my story. I was told really early on, I'm just going to say this first, to identify, not compare, because everyone has their different stories, you know? And it's really easy for me when I'm in a state of comparing. It's my way of walking myself out of here and to identify with the feelings rather than try and compare the stories. Because my story might look really different than yours. I grew up in an Orthodox Jewish home. There you go. That's different than probably a lot of people in here. There are some here that have. But that's an easy way to difference. But that doesn't really matter. You know, people, whatever. So I'll just share my story. I troublemaker kid, you know, two parents. I was a huge troublemaker from a really early age. I had these thoughts that, my idea was to be the best, and since I couldn't be the best, I was going to be the worst. And it's better to get bad attention than no attention. Those were like really strong ideas that I had at a really young age. I picked up other ones like, if I'm happy, then, if I appear happy, you're going to like me, so I have to lie and pretend I'm happy because no one wants to be around miserable people. So I came up with all these stories at a very young age that I believed. And it worked for me for a little bit, you know. And I remember I was a class clown, and I was always kicked out of class. And one day I was 11 years old. So being part of like an Orthodox Jewish home, my family celebrated the Sabbath. And so Friday night and Saturday day, there was alcohol on the table for the ritual, the Sabbath dinner and lunch. And so I was that little kid that always had my hand out, like, give me more, it's not fair, you gave that sibling more than me, and that sibling, you know, whatever. So they wouldn't. And I would try to convince my siblings to give me theirs because it's not fair. I don't know, they didn't either. Even if they were just not drinking it, they still wouldn't give it to me, and it would really bother me. So the next part after having that little bit of wine was to go into the other room in the kitchen to go wash their hands over bread, and then come back and have the rest of the meal. And so I figured out somewhere, like, it's not fair they're not giving it to me, I'm going to have to take it. So while everyone's going to the other room to go wash their hands, I'm chugging down from the bottle of wine as much as I can get into my body as fast as I can while listening to hear if anyone's coming. This is a really young age. And that's what I did. And then throughout the rest of the meal, I was trying to convince them that they should give me more alcohol. Yeah. So that was just me. So one day, there's another holiday called Purim. That's a big drinking holiday. And so I made sure to help out, quote unquote, help out. I never helped. You know, my mom's like, hey, Chaya, you know, can you put your plate into the sink? And I turn to her and be like, nobody's slave. But some, that was me. And then totally entitled and twisted perspective. And here I am, like, you know, suddenly willing to help. You know, like all flags should go up. Like, what's going on with this? And it was because there were these gift baskets of food and drink and alcohol that would come into the house. And so if I was helping, then I got to take what I wanted. So I had taken a bunch of the little bottles of vodka and stuff and like stolen that and put it in the bottom drawer in my room, and I hid it there. And I was young, 10 probably, 11, I don't know, but definitely about that time. And one day I'm in school and something happened. I was being my usual class clown self, and someone said to me, you know, Chaya, at recess, she said, you know, we're not laughing with you, we're laughing at you. And I went home that night, and I sat down, well, that day, sat down on my bed, and I'm crying, like, what a hard life I have, I'm 11, and, like, they're laughing at me, I'm like a piece of shit, and, like, I just hate myself, and I have this thought, like, I need a personality change, and that's exactly the thought that went through my head, I need a personality change, and suddenly it was like a flashlight, like a light bulb, whatever, went off in my head, and I opened up the drawer, the bottom drawer, and I pulled out the vodka, because I knew this is what makes me feel better. And I started drinking, and it was like this sense of like the ease, like that, and comfort that happens. You know, it's like that true magical joy, like the elixir for life. You know, and it was like something just happened to me, and I was like, I became smart, tall, pretty. I became everything that I thought that God had meant to make me, but just failed miserably. And I thought like, if I only have alcohol for the rest of my life, I'll be okay. And so that started my, like, secret love affair relationship with alcohol in privacy, in my own room, when I'd come home from school or whatever. And it was just about, like, my family drank. There was alcohol around, and, you know, I did that thing where I'd take the vodka and I'd pour it into a glass of whatever. At that point, I was drinking lots of screwdrivers and putting water into the vodka bottle, and it's in the freezer, and there's condensation that happens, but I don't understand it yet. I remember thinking, like, oh, that's kind of weird, but, like, just no concept of it. And, but it's, you know, my family's, like, drinkers-ish, but, so, like, it just, it wasn't noticed, and there was more bottles, and it, I don't know, it just worked just fine for me. I remember once my dad caught me, like, stealing vodka. He's like, what are you doing? And I was like, oh, I can't sleep. And, like, I convinced my dad that it's okay to give me vodka, like, and it, don't worry, it's just a screwdriver. I did a lot of, like, manipulation stuff, and he let me. But my parents were big believers that if you drink in the house, it's okay. Just don't, like, we know you're going to do what you want to do probably out there, so we'd rather have it under our, you know, under our house so that we know you're okay. And I had an older brother who was drinking a lot and partying and stuff, so there was always stuff around. And my house was like the crazy party house that everyone moved into when they had problems with their family members, and it was a crazy party house. I'm going to fast forward a lot, but essentially I found this magic, and I chased it really hard. And the choices that I was making were getting worse and worse. I at 12, found my drinking buddy, and we just were off to the races. And I was a club kid when I was 14, doing my thing, lying to my parents, and they're, you know, the things that I pulled were crazy. I just kind of packed a bag and moved out to friends' houses, and I'd come home about once a week to do laundry and change my backpack of clothing and maybe eat a real meal and maybe get a night's sleep. And then I'd just be back out at different friends' houses. And I was still going to school because that's where we got to party, you know? Like, lunch break was, like, drinking time. Anyhow, consequences happened, and for me, I never connected it with alcohol. It was just like one of those things that you just do. You know, you're having a good time, and I chased after that feeling of freedom that I thought I was getting. And then what happened was I got kicked out of school when I was 15 for smoking and drinking on a school Shabbaton. That's a weekend thing. They kicked me out, and I was like, but everyone else is drinking, and they're like, you're a ringleader. And they told me that the only way I can the only way I can come back to school is if I go to an outpatient program. So here I am, 15 years old, in an outpatient program, and thinking, like, I'm not that bad. Like, all I do is drink. Like, these people are, like, doing heroin and stuff. Like, what? You know, so I was doing some, like, you know, pills and stuff like that, snorting copious amounts of it. But, like, you know, but that's prescripted stuff. It doesn't count. Although it wasn't my prescription, but whatever. And so I just had all this stuff, and, you know, they said certain things that I kind of a little bit heard, but just didn't get. Like, you know, the first drink is too much, a thousand's never enough. And I was like, huh? Until I got it. And then I really got it. And that, you know, and they asked me what I thought an alcoholic is, and I said someone who's old and dirty and lives under a bridge. And it can't be me because I'm 15 and, like, I still have keys, a key to my parents' house. They gave me one, not both. You know, I thought, like, that, and they said, you know, if you continue, that will be you. Mm. Fast forward a lot, I decided to go live on top of a mountain in a different country and be away. My friends were also in that same country, but 4 hours south. And so I thought, if I'm living on this mountain, I'm going to be okay, right? And I started doing things like I stopped drinking, but I thought if I do things I don't like, I won't get addicted to it. So I did drugs I didn't like, and I would drink bottles of cough syrup, but I thought it doesn't count because it's just cough syrup, although there's tons of alcohol in it. But that was like, you know, the robo-tripping thing. And then I was dating someone who was bringing me stuff, and it was just crazy. And I did a lot of stuff. And my parents actually sent my older brother to that country to come help me because I was like, I'm gonna drink. Like, that alcohol was my best friend. It was like the one thing that made me feel right in my skin. And like, it was hell. Like, to be parted from it for that time period was just really hard. And I had no solution. And for me, I thought religion's going to fix me. And so I became extremely religious. And I thought it did not do a thing for me. Like, in that regard, I was miserable. And I was, like, praying and doing all this stuff and, like, wanting to die on the inside and being like, I just don't get it. It's old ideas that if I move a certain way when I'm praying, or if I say the prayers slowly and I concentrate on the prayers, I'm going to be okay. Like, everything, you know. It was a very, like, conditional God that I had. What ended up happening was that I came back to America. I was dating someone who I thought had a problem. Shocker. Went to a meeting for him. And that was it. I'd heard about... In the outpatient program, they never talked about AA. One person had asked something in a group saying, what do you guys think about 12-step programs? And the group leader had said, oh, we don't believe in them because of the whole God thing. And right there, contempt prior to investigation, I was like, whatever that 12-step stuff that talks about God is, I want nothing to do with it. And so here I am, like, totally feeling hopeless and trying everything on my own resources to, like, not drink or to drink and stay sane. It was just intensely crazy. You know, and it talks about, like, this, you know, can you control and enjoy your drinking? Like, that big question. And if I was controlling it, I wasn't enjoying it. And if I was enjoying it, I wasn't controlling it, you know? And I get that, because, like, that's where I was in the state of, like, trying to be okay, but not at all being okay. Long story, but I'm sitting in my parents' house. I'm 22. And I aged myself. Okay. And I'm sitting there watching TV, and I just want out. Like, I'm praying at this point for a bus or a train to come and hit me so that I could be free. So that's it. I couldn't live. I couldn't continue living the way I was living. I was so badly hungover and miserable. And I just was crawling on the bottom, you know, and I thought, because I knew if I tried to kill myself, I probably wouldn't die. My fear was that I'd be stuck alive in my body, and I couldn't ask anyone to get me high, and so I'd just be stuck in my head, you know, in a vegetative state, and so I was just praying, like, suddenly here I am, you know, praying to God to just take my life away from me, like a bus or a train to hit me, and this guy came over to my house, and 3 weeks before I'd gotten him help from a friend that was in, well, someone that I knew, who later became a friend, who was in an outpatient program. She had brought him to a meeting. And so he comes to my house to pick up my sister's friend to bring him to a meeting and asked me, just nonchalantly turned to me, he's like, hey, Chaya, do you want to come to a meeting? And I was like, okay. I went. And I heard this woman was sitting in the front of the room, and she did not look anything like me. We had nothing in common except for the fact that we were the same gender. She talked, and... when she talked about this despair and this inability to control her drinking and, like, what happened to her when she drank. And she talked about alcoholism, and I was like, I got it. Something, like, cracked inside of me. You know, I was that person that was, like, the life of the party, and here I am, like, I felt like no one got it. And here I am, this woman who is nothing like me, who's talking, and she gets me. She really gets me. Like, I finally found out what was wrong with me for 22 years of my life that I had no words for. I just knew there was something fundamentally wrong with me. And she talked about alcoholism, and I knew. And it was like a dam broke open inside of me, and I just bawled my eyes out. And I probably cried for my first 9 months sober. So if anyone remembers me from back then, I was a baller. I was that person that spent 2 hours getting dressed before a meeting because I thought if I looked good on the outside, you wouldn't know how not okay I was on the inside. And so I would look perfect on the outside, and then people would talk, and I'd identify, and I just couldn't keep it together. It was sobs. Like, like really loud. And I'd wear these really cute fedora hats with my perfectly made hair and my perfectly made up face, and I just pull them down over my face and just sob. So I learned that if I sit all the way in the front and I'm crying, when someone next to me shares, no one could see my face, you know? Thanks. But if I'm sitting in the back and I'm crying and someone next to me shares, everyone's going to turn around and see me. So I learned very early on to sit in the front. And then for later reasons, it made sense for me to sit in the front because I had such a hard time paying attention. All right. So the good stuff. So what happened for me was that I came into, I was at the meeting, Youth Enjoying Sobriety on Saturday night. And this woman who was sitting in the front of the room, blonde hair and pigtails, blue eyes, looked like an angel. And I was like, she was smiling. And I was like, bitch, we have nothing in common. They said I could curse. But that was literally the thought that went through my head. She looked like an angel just dropped her out of the sky and she landed in the front of the room, and I was like, not liking her one bit. And I was angry. Like, I was like miserable, unhappy, Saturday night, here I am. All my friends are partying and doing all that crazy stuff, and I'm sitting in an AA meeting with a whole bunch of young people that I don't know how to communicate with, and I don't know how to make friends, and I don't know how to do anything, like, at all. I felt like I was left legs and left arms all over the place and tripping over myself, and I was like, I just crawling out of my skin. And then she started talking, and when she started talking, it was like, holy cow. She talked about, being homeless by choice when she was 14. She talked about panhandling for money. She talked about her plan every morning when she woke up was to get enough money to get into the club for that night. So when she got into the club, she got all the alcohol and drugs that she wanted for free. So that was her plan. Every single morning, that was her goal. And then when she had enough money, once she had enough money to get in there, if she had money left over, she'd buy herself a pack of cigarettes. If she still had money left over after that, she'd pool it with other people to get a hotel room for the night. And if she still had money left over after that, she'd spend 75 cents on a bowl of rice. And I thought, oh my God, like, how did she go from being that street rat that I was to being this woman of grace and dignity, like, who's laughing? Like, beyond my wildest dreams was laughing. Like, what I wanted when I got sober is to not want to die every single second. You know, and so laughter was not even on my periphery at all. And I walked up to her after, and I talked with her, and I asked her to sponsor me. And she said, you know, I asked her, like, what she did, and she said she got a sponsor. She met with her sponsor weekly. She worked the 12 steps with her sponsor. They did reading out of the big book, and she did the assignments that her sponsor told her to. She said that prayed every morning and asked God to keep her sober for that day, and she thanked God at night, or she didn't say God. She said she prayed to whatever kept her sober yesterday to keep her sober for today, and thanked whatever power that kept her sober to, she just thanked it for doing that. And she talked about reaching out to others and she said something that was really powerful. She said, do three selfless acts each day. And I thought, what the heck do selfless acts have to do with staying sober? It has everything to do with staying sober. Because that spiritual awakening that they talk about in the big book is about, you know, we go from the first step, which is selfishness and self-centeredness. That is the root of my troubles. That is me and my element. I am like that entitled brat of a human being to being someone who could be considerate and kind and thoughtful of other people. You know, to like, I never understood even the concept of volunteering. Like, why would you volunteer when you can get paid for it? I did not understand altruism. Like, that blew my mind. Like, I was just like, they're really dumb. Like, what's wrong with these people? That was self-centeredness and selfishness that to the core. That was me. You know, and today I understand in a whole different light. And so for me, doing three selfless acts was huge, because I realized that through having to do these three selfless acts, I realized I didn't do selfless acts. Mm. And then I stopped telling my sponsor when I was doing them, because I realized that I really had a selfish motive when I was telling her, because I wanted her, like, praise. And then I was like, oh, I think I'm changing. And so I met with my sponsor weekly, and I started, and I was doing these steps, you know, and I knew I was powerless over alcohol. I knew when I took a drink, it owned me. I knew, but I had a problem with unmanageability, because I thought, you know, I got sober at 22, I had money in the bank, I had, you know, my parents still let me sleep in their house, I still had friends, like, how's my life unmanageable? And someone said to me, hi, you know, is your life unbearable? And I said, yeah. And she's like, unbearable is emotional unmanageability. Mm. And I went, oh. And through that, I was able to do my first step. But the funny thing is that my life was beyond unmanageable. I just couldn't see it at the time. Like, I'd been kicked out of school when I was 15 and I didn't finish school, you know? I was, like, making choices to work. I ran away. I did, like, crazy stuff. And my life was beyond, I was hanging out with, like, scum of the earth. I hope none of them are this. But yeah, I was hanging out with some really pretty low people out there. I put myself in dangerous situations all the time. And for me, it was like, you know, so it took me about 6 months to realize how unmanageable my life was. But, you know, I got it with the unbearable part. Like, that for me was enough for me to do my first step. The second step, coming to believe in a power greater than myself that could restore me to sanity, was you guys. Was Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole that could restore me to sanity. You guys did it. Maybe if I do what you do, then maybe it could restore me to sanity too. So I became willing to turn my will and my life over to you guys. That's my thoughts, my actions, everything. I'm like, all right, give it, you know. I was told that the way that I proved that I did my third step is by doing my fourth step. So I said, okay, start doing the writing. And then I was like, oh, this is uncomfortable. So I sat on it for 6 months, and I really didn't get the point of it. Like, the point is that it's a fearless and thorough inventory, and that it's a fact-finding and fact-facing process. It has nothing to do with feelings. Mm. And I just sat in this pity pot of pain, and that wasn't the point. It's the whole point of it was to get rid of the unsaleable goods. It's the stuff that doesn't work for me. That's it. You know, and I was told that the fourth step promises is now you get to see a chunk of truth about yourself. And that's all I ever wanted, was to figure myself out, because I was so self-obsessed. And what happened was, when I did my fourth step, is that I got the chunk of truth about myself, that I was selfish and self-centered. And everything, even when I was smiling, the line, like, weren't we self-seeking when we were kind? I didn't want to look at my sponsor when I read that out of the big book, because I thought, oh, she's going to see right through me. That's totally me. What happened was that I was on my fourth step, and I was, like, going to kill myself. I had the thought that went through my head is that I'm going to rip this up and pretend this never existed. And then I thought, yeah, but I still know this stuff is out there. Mm. So I thought, oh, I should just kill myself. First it was I should drink. And then I thought, oh, no, I'm going to have a sober breath, like, eventually, right, in between drinks. And then I'm still going to know it's there, so then I should kill myself. And at that point, I called that friend that helped me with the first step, and she said, read the fifth step promises. And I did, and it's talked about being able to look the world in the eye and be at perfect peace and ease. And she asked me, do you want that? And I said, yeah. And she said, all right, well, every time before you sit down to do your fourth step, because I just had a little bit left to do, she said, read this and pray to keep the feelings out of it. And so I got it done right away, like, right after doing this process, like, after coming to that place of pain, I was willing. And then I met with my sponsor, and I have, like, these ideas that if I share the truth about myself, like, if you knew everything about me, you will not like me. I didn't like me, you know? And what I did was I managed, lots of people knew little bits of me, but no one knew all of me. And I had so much fear that if I do this fifth step with my sponsor, the one person who, like, maybe has, like, some secret clue on how to fix me, that she's going to stop talking to me. And so I was really afraid. And so I did it anyhow. I told her that I wanted to do it with someone else. And she said, sure, you know, if you'd like to do it with someone else, that's okay, you could. But I would suggest that you continue working the rest of the steps with them, because that's the only way that, you know, like, to do your ninth step amends, like, you need someone to know your fifth step. And I went, but I don't want another sponsor. I want you. And because I was just afraid. It was just fear. But I walked through that fear, and I did my fifth step. But what I did tell her was that if she, I told her that if she, I'll do it on the condition that she doesn't say anything. So pretty much I held this woman hostage for 11 hours while I did my fifth step. And then I stayed at her house for an hour after to do the sixth step and seventh step. And she didn't say a word through all that. Years later, I really regret that because she probably had some really amazing insight to say. But that was my self-will speaking, and she knew that I needed the freedom. I needed that to let it out. And so she was willing to not say anything. And then I continued with the 6 and 7, and I became willing. I came to a place of like willingness to have that, because I hated the stuff that I saw about me. I became willing to have that removed, and through seeing my character defects and how they were harming me and how they were affecting others. And I went about making that list for the 8th step, and one of the big, 45 seconds left, one of the big amends that I made was to my parents, was a huge one. Like, they were going into a foreclosure, and I was manipulating them for money, because I thought they owed me, because they were paying for my sister's two apartments when she got married, one for her husband in medical school and one for her in law school, and I thought, I deserve, but I had $25,000 in the bank while I was doing this. So when I made that amends to my parents, I thought my dad was going to kill me. I made the amends outside on the stairwell of my parents' house because I thought he'd snap my neck. And my friend was inside with the friend that helped me with the first step and my fourth step was inside with my mom. I made that amends to her, to my dad, and he started crying and told me he loved me and he wished he could have helped me more. And that was like a huge gift. Like, this is freedom, like being able to look my parents in the eye and be at perfect peace and ease with them, with people about me in this world, you know? And so the steps, they continues. Like, it's just a day at a time doing this deal. But, like, today I can look myself in the mirror, can look myself in the eye. I can look others in the eye, and I can have true freedom. Like, nothing, I don't have this stuff that weighs on me anymore at all. Like, I feel like I can float when I walk, you know? And that's, like, that's freedom for me. Because every single step I took in the past was painful. It was brutal. And you know, I have a relationship with a power greater than me that has definitely restored me to sanity, that continues to restore me to sanity so long as I'm willing to let it. And I keep coming because you guys saved my life on a daily basis still. And thanks.